WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Noah Bookstein with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, April 14th. The city of Sarasota has begun replacing all residential water meters. Crews started work in North Sarasota. The city says new meters will help improve resiliency and metering accuracy. Work will cause limited interruptions to water service. Customers will receive advanced notice in the mail. Increased accuracy of the water meters could mean a change up or down in your water bill. The project is set to continue over the next 2 years. Scientists will gather at the Bay Park for a panel discussion tomorrow. The free event, moderated by Suncoast Searchlight, is called Beneath the Surface, the Environmental Stories Shaping Our Community. It will take place tomorrow, Wednesday, April 15th at 3 p.m. inside the Bayfront Community Center. Attendees will be able to learn from scientists and advocates about some of the region's most important environmental challenges, including water pollution and habitat loss. Panelists include a researcher on dolphins in the Sarasota Bay, a researcher studying the impacts of local waterway pollution, and a scientist who leads a group dedicated to raising awareness of local scientific work. Gulf Islands Ferry added a third vessel to its fleet. The new boat, called the Manatee Belle, is intended to help ease congestion on busy roads between downtown Bradenton and Anna Maria Island. The new vessel is equipped with 91 seats, an indoor cabin, and climate control. The Gulf Islands Ferry Initiative started in 2024 with public funds from a tourist development tax. The program provides travelers with an alternative to driving. Bradenton officials estimate that over 50,000 passengers used the ferry in 2025, helping decrease traffic by over 20,000 cars. Driven by historic drought conditions, Florida wildfires hit new records. Fire ignitions have more than tripled at this point in the year compared to the same time last year. Florida fires have been more severe and longer lasting, with increased ignitions expected as peak fire season approaches in June. With nearly the entire state currently experiencing drought conditions, many counties have implemented burn bans to mitigate wildfire risks. While Sarasota County enacted such a ban in October, current local conditions remain below the mandatory threshold. Therefore, no burn ban is in effect for Sarasota County at this time. This has been Noah Bookstein with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, April 14th.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
This is show 85 of our changing environment. The previous show usually was Melody Matrix, hosted by Neil, but he wasn't in today.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm John O'Miller, and the show is being broadcast on April 14th, 2026.
We're joined by Dr. Rebecca Acosta, who hosts the Healthy Living Hour on alternate Tuesdays. And we're going to be talking with Jennifer Schaefer, co-executive director of the Science and Environment Council of Southwest Florida, talking about the SEC and EcoBeat.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Jennifer, it's great to have you back on the show. Before we get into EcoBeat, tell us about the Science and Environment Council.
Well, thanks, Julie. Thanks, Jono, for having me here today. The Science and Environment Council is a coalition of science-based environmental organizations, including nonprofits, small for-profit LLCs, government agencies and municipalities, counties, 47 members across the region from Tampa Bay to Charlotte Harbor. And I would say we're a really unusual organization. I don't know of another collaborative group like ours in Florida or even the nation. And the Science and Environment Council's mission is to engage the public and increase understanding of science-based environmental issues through outreach, education, convening, and primarily the collaboration across our member organizations. We do things together that no single member might do on their own. Just makes more sense for us to collaborate for greater results. So that's the Science and Environment Council. We've been around since 2001. So if you do the math, what's that, 25 years?
It's an anniversary. How are you celebrating?
We are fundraising.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a question. How is the SEC supported?
That's a great question. Our operating expenses, which are very modest, are fully supported by, mostly supported by our member dues. And then all of the project work we do is grant-supported or sponsor-supported. So we have long-term stability through our dues structure, but we also are deeply connected in the community through philanthropy and grant makers in order to cobble together the funds to do these special collaborative projects.
So one of your projects has been the Green Living Toolkit, right?
That's right. That's a great example of a collaborative work. The Green Living Toolkit is an online resource which we often refer people to when they say, what can I do? So across our 47 organizations, that's probably the number one question. And there's many things that a person can do, not only in their own lives, but through the community as well. So together, we curated a list, a toolkit, rather, of the top 15 things across five sustainability categories of things that people can do for water, waste, energy, nature, and food. So these are things that we deemed the most impactful, where they were the most feasible for someone to take on, and where there were local resources, actual people in our network that you can call to get professional advice on how to get started. So this is the Green Living Toolkit, and it's just one example of how together we can combine our resources and our deep knowledge base into a publicly facing product, a toolkit, that really enhances our and synergizes our work.
So I would imagine a number of your organizations are nonprofits that are going to be participating in the Giving Challenge?
I would hope 100% of them.
Okay.
I've been getting a lot of emails.
So, Julie, tell us about the Giving Challenge.
The Giving Challenge runs from noon April 15th until noon April 16th. During that time, donations between $25 and $100 are matched. Right now, we're taking pledges. Call 941-894-6469 to make your pledge, and we'll process it when the challenge begins so your gift is matched. It's simple, it's powerful, and it makes a real difference for the station. And call 941-894-6469.
And when you can call in, you can indicate what shows, if any, in particular you're supporting. It could be the Healthy Living Hour or Changing Environment or The Detail or one of the many music shows or some of our syndicated shows. So you have a chance to indicate that when you call in.
And now let me also add that all donations, all individual donations from $25 up to $100 will be matched by the Patterson Foundation. So this is a unique opportunity in the year to double your impact right away. And speaking of pledges,
yes,
I would like to offer a matching pledge.
What?
If someone calls during the next hour during our show,
yeah,
I will double my pledge.
Oh, my goodness. All right.
Thank you.
So hit the phones, people.
And the phone number again is 941-894-6469. To make your pledge.
Okay.
So let's talk about EcoBeat, Jennifer.
Sure. Thanks, Julie. The EcoBeat project is the latest in our collaborative work. And at its core, it's a toolkit that is built for journalists and newsrooms. So we do have public-facing components of it, but it's primarily meant as a tool to drive more and better coverage of environmental issues in our local news ecosphere. EcoBeat started as a sort of a workshop. Science and Environment Council, we have quarterly meetings. One of our meetings was dedicated to environmental storytelling. How do we get our messages out into the community? How do we help the public understand the complexity and nuances of science that drives our environmental issues and our environmental policy making? And as we talked, we sort of came to the conclusion that, you know, maybe we need to write better press releases. Maybe we need to, you know, boost our social media for a wider audience, a wider reach. But we came to the conclusion that the bottleneck was really the eroding newsrooms, that there's been a dramatic shift in the capacity of newsrooms with regard to the number of journalists, number of investigative reporters, and the amount or volume of news that they can generate locally. We've seen a lot of our news kind of get syndicated.
Yeah, and that's been, the problem's been amplified by the fact that there's so much more environmental news all of a sudden.
That was kind of how we were looking at it.
So fewer people, fewer, less support from the media, and more issues to be discussed. We didn't think we'd have to talk about getting rid of the Forest Service or relocating it or whatever, but all of a sudden that's a thing.
Right. So we concluded that journalists didn't need more press releases. They needed the tools to quickly identify what the top issues are, figure out who the experts are that they can get their background or their quotes from, and even figure out where the open data sets are for the investigative journalists that like to dig in. So that's how our environmental storytelling workshop turned into a brainstorm of how to create a toolkit aimed at journalists and newsrooms. And that toolkit is launching tomorrow, April 15th, with a special event collaborating with Suncoast Searchlight. We just heard about it during the break, during the news broadcast.
Fortuitous.
Yes, beneath the surface at the Bayfront Community Center tomorrow at 3 p.m. So EcoBeat is exactly what we just laid out. It is a utility, really, for journalists to quickly access experts, timely story tips, and open data sets. And it's been designed as a curated best of from our 47 organizations who submit their stories, open data sets that they'd like explored or featured, as well as submitting their experts who, by virtue of agreeing to be in the database, are available for quotes and available to meet deadlines.
So there's some sort of searchable database if you're interested in dolphins or flooding or...
Right.
Okay.
Each of the three data types that I just mentioned, the story tips, the experts, and the databases, are featured on their own searchable pages and very visually easy to digest. You can scan through all of the options, or it has a really robust search function. You can search by organization. You can search by region. You can search by region, meaning county or Gulf of America wide. Sorry, I tripped over that. And you can search by keyword. You can search by topic. And the topics are standardized to 11 of the most commonly understood environmental topics. So it's very, very fast and very easy to use. It's designed to facilitate journalists' work, not bog them down in a sort of onerous process.
And presumably, virtually all of these experts are local.
Yes.
Okay.
They are experts that come from our member organizations, as well as some specific topical experts. I think we have a few from the University of Florida. And we are looking to expand that list.
Yeah, I could suggest a cabbage palm expert.
You are invited to submit.
Thank you.
There is a link, I believe, on the website for experts who want to be included to join. So the tool is just launching. We didn't do it in a vacuum, though. After our workshop, which was almost exactly a year ago, we started developing the idea. We started talking to our local foundations. We started talking to local journalists. Is this anything? Is this an idea that would be helpful to you? You know, rather than building it and hoping they would come,
right.
We built it to suit them. So we asked them, we surveyed, we did focus groups to find out what exact type of tools would you be interested in using. And the feedback so far has been very positive, that it is definitely a useful tool, and we are watching our web analytics, of course, to see what's happening with regard to page loads and usage and downloads, et cetera. So far, it's looking pretty good. We intend to update it monthly. And in conjunction with that update, all the journalists, participating journalists who sign up to be on our email list will receive an update right to their inbox, indicating what's new in the database, what are the hot story tips for May, who are the new experts that have been added, what's the featured database that you might be interested in exploring. So it's meant to keep this tool top of mind, to make it very easy for journalists to just click through from their email. Obviously, we hope they will bookmark it. There's even an option to download these databases onto their desktop. Of course, they'd want to do that monthly in order to get the latest updates.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Acosta, can you pitch for the giving challenge?
Absolutely. Thank you, and thanks for having me here. I look forward to these when we come together. If anybody's listening or has been listening the past week to anything on WSLR, I think we're all aware that right now everyone here at WSLR is working together to build momentum going into the Giving Challenge, which starts tomorrow at noon. Each of us is reaching out, bringing people in, and making sure we're ready when it starts noon tomorrow, and you can be part of that. You know, we are built on volunteers and community supported. I'm a volunteer. Julie and Jono are volunteers. And so maybe you're not able to give your time or you're limited on mobility, but there is ways you can participate and still be part of this community. You can call 941-894-6469 and make your pledge today, and we'll activate it when the challenge opens tomorrow so that your contribution between $25 and $100 is matched dollar for dollar. This is a collective effort. And I think we all have really seen, you know, personally, the impact of community these past few years when there was so much isolation going on a number of years ago. And we're seeing the detriment of that. And so I think this is a great time to build that again together. So please call right now, 941-894-6469. And make sure to mention our changing environment when you call in.
Yeah. This is great because people could call in now and then they don't have to worry about remembering or getting up in the middle of the night and saying, so this would be great. Go ahead and call.
And so the number again is 941-894-6469. And Jennifer, did you have some questions for us?
Yeah, one of the key questions that we ask when we're trying to bring environmental issues to life, to to bring them to the public through our local media is naturally, you know, what are the hidden issues? What are the issues that scientists are talking about that perhaps aren't breaking through into the public discourse? Or perhaps they're already in the public discourse but are not fully described or understood in terms of impact. So as part of our development of EcoBeat and as longtime local environmental experts, I'm turning the tables a little bit on our interview to ask you guys with regard to topics that are undercovered or misunderstood by the public, where should we focus our local newsrooms and journalists?
Well, as we noted earlier, there's no shortage of topics right now, but there are probably some that are under-investigated. The one that's been occurring to me lately, and I've been talking a little with Steve Swah around the edges, we're going to have him on the show later in next month, I think. There's always this sort of sensational headline that appears, like, will we have enough water, and is the water running out? And my contention is, no, we're not running out of water. We'll always have enough water because you typically get like 52 inches of rain a year. So if that was cut in half, it would be 26, and that's still more than people in the arid Southwest or the Middle East are getting, and they seem to be getting water. So the question isn't, will people get enough water? The question is, how are we using it, and at what expense? Like, when we take water from the system, whether it's the Peace River or an aquifer, who's losing on that deal? So does that, if we take more water from a given aquifer, does that somehow jeopardize warm mineral springs? If we pump more on the Carlton Reserve, is that affecting, they were supposed to be monitoring the health of the wetlands out there, is it still taking place? If we take water from the Peace River, how does that affect Charlotte Harbor? It, you know, there's minimum flows and levels, but those were designed to sort of maximize how much water people could take. So I think we need to have a deeper conversation about when we increase our water demand, whose ox is getting gored? What system or what wildlife or what plants are going to be affected by our insistence on having plenty of water?
Yeah, I've wondered that myself, too. When we're encouraged to conserve water, you know, turn off the tap when you're brushing your teeth, get low water, high efficiency appliances, who are we saving that water for?
The next million people. So, part of the issue for that is there are a lot of fixed costs with water supply development, things that have to be paid no matter how much water is being used. And so the more we could end up in a cycle where we cut our demand in half, but then they have to raise the rates to cover fixed costs. So one of the things I've advocated in the past is that when you get water delivered to your house by a municipal water service, you're really getting two things. You're getting the water to use in your house or your yard, but you're also getting water pressure to fight fires. And I've suggested that your water bill should have one bill for the amount of water you're using in the house, but another bill that's attributed to the ability to maintain the fire flows, because they're using the same pipes. So when they replace a pipe, it shouldn't be charged just against you using water, but it's part of what you're paying for, so that if there is a fire, there's sufficient pressure. So I think people would be more comfortable, I think it would be easier to justify paying money to make sure we could fight a fire than, you know, raising rates because people are being more efficient. So that's another thing that might be explored.
So I would like to focus on rising sea level, because the Gulf of Mexico is hotter than it should be, and that causes the water to expand. And I think it's underreported how fast sea level rise is accelerating.
Well, I think it's underreported how much evidence there is that it's already affected systems.
Right.
You know, you can go out to St. Armand's and look in the storm sewers, but you can go up to the Big Bend coast and see all the palm trees dying, and that's because of rising sea level. So, yeah, that's a good one, Julie.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that that is an issue that is can be very visual, so it does lend itself to discussing in sort of a public context. Both imagery, as Jono said, there are very dramatic changes to the natural environment we can see. As well, there are impacts that we can notice on high tides where there is seawater backing up through the storm drains.
Yeah.
And it's pooling in our streets, even on sunny days, the so-called sunny day flooding. So that's very photographable. That is very much a story through imagery. And so in addition to those real-world images, there are some really great sea level rise viewers online. Very easy to use. NOAA probably has the best one. That's NOAA, the federal agency.
Oh, not the guy.
And so that's a great way to allow the public to sort of fiddle with scenarios that the viewer allows for the user to dial up certain levels of sea level rise. They can look at those changes on a map and see where the impacts are greatest. It's really interesting to see the impact of sea level rise on our coastline because it's not flat. We're not all at the same elevation.
Mm-hmm.
North County tends to be at a higher elevation, South County much lower. And so you can really see those inundation areas.
Much lower. That whole Cape Hayes Peninsula probably should never have been. I don't know who has access to the New York Times, but today's Sunday Times section, or some Science Times section, has a big section on cities around the world that are going to be impacted, already being impacted by rising sea level. And one of the examples on the inside is Miami. And we tend to think of rising sea level as creeping up the shoreline. But when you look at the map for Miami, you see inland areas that are going to be affected. And what's going on there is that the limestone under Miami, under South Florida, is porous. So when the water comes up in one area, it's also rising subterraneally. Mm-hmm. And flooding sort of back behind where you thought it was going to be. So we're particularly vexed in Florida, not only because we start out relatively flat, but also because of the underlying limestone structure that allows water to move around down there.
Yes, absolutely. And that's I think, a little understood aspect of sea level rise. And a correlate to that is that seawater can seep into our groundwater supply because it's all moving laterally underwater. And this is actually a demonstrable concern in South Florida where they have a whole network of specific wells that are placed in order to measure seawater intrusion into the aquifers that are used for drinking water. When it gets too salty, they know it's time to move the well.
The storms, Helene and Debbie, were offshore 100 miles or more, and they caused a tremendous storm surge on our barrier islands. And that created a lot of damage to homes and roads. Yes.
Yes. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. And they were 100 miles offshore, and so that is just another factor of climate change.
Yeah, I think it's also true, objectively true, that the intensity of storms in the Gulf or even crossing the Atlantic is greater with greater ocean temperature. It's just basic physical science.
Mm-hmm.
And so the intensity can ramp up very quickly as a hurricane passes across the Gulf and feeds on the energy, particularly as it hits the shelf where waters are relatively more shallow.
Yeah, this rapid intensification is something we didn't talk about 10 years ago, and now it comes up every hurricane season.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think that's a really great point that you bring up, Julie, and it kind of highlights another issue that I think is not underreported, but underexplained, maybe. And that is that we often talk about, heavy rainfall, we got flooded, hurricanes, again, flooding and wind damage. We weren't expecting that. This has never happened before. I've lived here for 40 years, and I've never seen anything like this.
Or 4 years.
Yeah.
And those aren't weather phenomenon, per se. They're treated as weather in the news, but it's part of a interconnected system of land use changes as well as climate changes. And understanding that everything that happens on land with regard to increasing impervious surfaces, which means surfaces like concrete, asphalt, rooftops that does not absorb and percolate rainfall, as well as the destruction of wetlands, as well as the reduction of natural areas, which are huge sponges, natural sponges for soaking up rainfall and returning it to our underground aquifers. Those are intricately linked with these so-called weather issues that we're experiencing.
Yeah, it's not just weather.
So you are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And let me introduce our guest. We're joined by Dr. Rebecca Acosta, who hosts the Healthy Living Hour and on Alternative Tuesdays. And we're talking with Jennifer Schaefer, co-executive director of the Science and Environment Council of Southwest Florida. And we're talking about EcoBeat, which is a new project that the SEC has rolled out. And Jono, do you want to do a pitch?
Yeah, we're not only talking about EcoBeat, we're talking about the Giving Challenge. And we're trying to remind people to call in today. The number is 941-894-6469. And that's the office number. And someone will take your information and what programs you might want to cite. And then that amount between $25 and $100 will be matched. So this is a great way to support the station. And I hope you'll call again, 941-894-6469. So, Jennifer, I wanted to ask, does your expert list include social scientists?
Indeed it does.
Okay, because
I have at least one.
Oh, well, I'm thinking, you know, one of the big issues that's affecting the environment is preemption by the Florida legislature. And every year we see folks in Tallahassee extending more and more control, telling local people what they can and cannot do. That's clearly has a social component. It's not just, you know, measuring numbers. And then there are issues related to public process. So during COVID, a lot of meetings were switched to online Zoom-type meetings, and a lot of those persisted. And that deprives the community of opportunities to interact directly with elected officials and what I refer to as the after parking lot meeting. When the meeting ends, people have a chance to go out and communicate with each other. These Zoom meetings, they typically turn off the chat function, so you cannot communicate with other people participating. So that's a real change in public process, and that would be a good article for someone to pick up on. Yeah.
And they've preempted local governments from having any net zero policies. In this legislative session.
So I think we need to have net 0.01 policies.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be my New Jersey approach to the whole thing.
There's the baseline.
There's a new way to visit the Bay Park in the city of Sarasota. Boaters can now pull up to the park at floating day docks on the south side of Centennial Park Boat Basin, just north of 10th Street. Currently, these docks can be used for up to 5 hours. Boaters must use the park mobile app to claim a space. Docks are first come, first served. Boats up to 40 feet are allowed. No overnight docking, 11 p.m. to 5 a.m. More information is available at thebaysarasota.org. So, another question for us, Jennifer?
Yeah, keep them coming here.
So, Jono, you've mentioned water, and Julie, yeah. You've mentioned sea level rise. Are there any issues around wildlife that you think need more attention?
We learned through our work with the Tampa Bay Estuary Program that mangroves are overcoming salt marshes, and that's happening all up and down the West Florida coast.
Because of changing climate?
No, because there are no longer freezes that restrain, that restrict the range of mangroves. Yep. And you know, there's more intertidal flow, and that affects salt marsh decline in terms of mangroves.
You may be suggesting that the Gulf salt marsh mink may be affected by the loss of salt marsh.
Well, and then there's all kinds of invertebrates that are associated with mangroves.
Maybe it was the Gulf salt marsh snake that would be impacted. Because she asked about wildlife. That's what I'm getting at here.
Right. Yeah. Right. And then there's all kinds of birds that nest in mangrove rookeries.
So, yeah, I think a real issue that people are aware of, but I don't think has been integrated very well, are the invasive species. And it's complicated. You know, it's clear that the Burmese pythons are having an effect on mammal populations, but a friend of ours says they don't, when they hatch, they're not 12 feet long. They're little snakes, and some animals are eating them. So it's not, it's a more complicated food web. But what we're seeing, possibly related to climate change, is that these animals are expanding in from southern Florida, moving up into areas. So, you know, we haven't experienced the falling iguana problem to the extent that the people in Miami do, but people are finding, you know, cold impacted lizards, and so this issue of what it would be interesting to write an article to say, well, here's what we have now, and here's if you plan on living here 20 years from now, here are some critters that you might expect to see. So, for instance, I'm seeing the agama lizards at City Hall, and they weren't there 5 years ago. And so things that we didn't used to have, we're having now, and that will affect our wildlife.
One of the things that journalists told us as we were assembling these resources was that when we pitch them stories, our hot story tips, we give them all the information they might need to sort of formulate the idea of what the story is. We tell them, you know, what's going on, who's involved, and why it matters.
Uh-huh.
And this is on the story card that
great.
You can find on the website. So the feedback we got there was, that's great. This really gives us a jump start on formulating stories. We know who to contact. We kind of know what the gist of it is. We can decide immediately whether this is what our newsroom is looking for. But the feedback they gave us as well was, we need to really understand why this matters to people. What is the human angle? And this is coming from, the executive editors.
Yeah,
this is coming from the media source itself. making the news relevant to the local community. Yeah. And so that's one area that is a little more difficult when sometimes the reason it matters is because it just does. There's an understanding that there's an inherent right for nature to exist, unfettered. But
We get tired of hearing that.
Yeah, and we want to know, you know, what we call nature a natural resource.
Uh-huh.
That tells you all you need to know.
Yeah.
And so if I turn that question back to you, why do we care that there's a new kind of lizard at City Hall?
Yeah. Well, I was going to skip from the lizard for a second, just because I saw one of the neighborhood social media apps sent out a warning saying, hey, the coyote's been sighted in our neighborhood, and they eat cats. Well, you know, that's if you have a cat, that's a big deal. And I don't know enough about the agama lizards to know how they affect things. What I would say is I think some of these cards could be tremendously useful in that you remember we had there was some federal program, and what people wanted was shovel-ready projects. They wanted you to have a document that was ready to go, and then if money was available, you would submit this thing and get going. I think journalists might want to consider something like that, where they have an invasive species story ready to go, but there's no trigger, there's no issue, there's no press, there's no buzz about it. But then all of a sudden, something happens. The agamas are loose inside City Hall, and it ends up on the front page of the paper. Where these lizards come from? Well, now this reporter has something that's 90% ready to go. So I think the question of how does it affect us may be sort of held in abeyance until it becomes clear how it affects us.
And maybe that's one of the strengths of this toolkit is that the resource is there. It's continually being grown with new stories and new experts. And those experts and stories may be relevant now. They may be relevant later. You know, maybe we hold the salt marsh mangrove story until National Mangrove Day. And then All of a sudden, it's a timely story.
Right.
So Penelope Morrison has donated to our show.
Thank you, Penelope.
Hey, all right. Thanks, Penelope.
Yeah.
I want to ask a question of Dr. Acosta, I'll say you're a public health expert. What are some of the environmental health issues that you see in our community that need more coverage?
Yeah, I think, and it probably doesn't affect our local Sarasota community, but I've got my finger on the pulse of what's happening with the AI and data centers. I mean, many of us in healthcare, a lot of people are using AI. I'm skeptical, but actually, I mean, I'm concerned about the impact on the environment of those data centers, the use of resources, and then also the impact on people's health who live there. I follow a group from my home state of Wisconsin who's actively trying to resist having that, and it looks like they're succeeding. Menominee Falls, I think it is, but you know, too, and then you know the warming and just how everything's getting hotter. And, we're seeing, you know, with migrant farmers there, you know, I think we had a death last year here just south of us of a young person who died from, you know, being overheated, a heat stroke or something. And, you know, and so, yeah, there's a lot. And it's hard, I think. And also, back to the AI stuff, I interviewed last week, not on my Healthy Living our program, but for another organization. But I actually interviewed a medical doctor in Greece who, you know, is very proficient in AI and sees where it's headed. And everybody wants to jump in. For me, I have caution. You know, I don't want to be part of that big, huge consumption, and where it can, you know, maybe it'll benefit me, but who does it harm? What does it harm?
Yeah, AI centers use a lot of electricity, and they use a lot of water to cool their to cool their servers.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're thinking about generating the electricity with natural gas and oil products. And now they're thinking about small nuclear reactors.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And the providing electricity for AI centers is very cost effective with renewables. Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, but your example regarding the worker who died, there's your intersection of government preemption, health effects, and climate change. So it's warmer, and Tallahassee says, well, you can't require people to have water breaks. We're not going to be doing that.
Or shade breaks.
Yeah, that's too woke, and people are just going to have to suck it up. And
suck it up and die?
Well, drink more Gatorade, which was developed here in Florida.
Oh. But too, with the AI thing, you know, like we have the 5G towers, and those emit EMF, electromagnetic frequencies. And interestingly, from a practitioner perspective, that EMF, it degrades the myelin sheath on the nervous tissue. It's the same mechanism in the disease process called MS, multiple sclerosis, which if anybody knows somebody, you know, they end up in a wheelchair. You end up in a wheelchair and a lot of health issues from that. So, yeah, I'm not certain. Jennifer, earlier outside before coming in, you mentioned about there's like a hum or a little buzz of those data centers.
Yeah, I had seen a report that even though they are sort of clean industrial, meaning that the building is fully contained, there's nothing going on outside, there is a very low frequency hum or vibration of the operation. Which nearby residents claim is interrupting their sleep patterns and causing just sort of general agitation and anxiety. I don't know of any studies that have objectively documented that, but that's the lived experience of some people who live near some of these centers.
Yeah, I'd like to look further into that. Thank you for bringing that up.
So, they've demonstrated that if wind power paints one of the rotors black, it really reduces the birds are able to see it. Migrating birds are able to see it, and that makes it visible to them, to the migrating birds.
So, if there's rotors that are black and white rotating, you mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If they add one, like they typically have three vanes or whatever, and if one of them's black, that apparently helps significantly.
I can see that.
Interesting.
But they're coming out with new designs for wind turbines that are not, that they're more columnar and have less things sticking out. So yeah. I think that technology will improve. The battery storage is improving. The solar technology is getting more efficient.
Yeah, I feel like we're at a speed bump, sort of a temporary impactful moment where AI is really in its infancy, and certainly the AI race speeding up the development, where seemingly every app you have, every device you have is now has an AI assist, whether you want it or not.
They keep asking me, do you want the AI version? I'm going, no, I just give me the answer. Don't.
So I think that we're at an awkward toddler, teenager, not quite sure what the correct analogy is with regard to supporting this technology. I don't think it's going back in the bottle. The genie is out, and I think it's going to for better or for worse, impact all areas of our lives, our civilization, let's say. With regard to innovation on the operations side, I've heard a certain person talk about AI data centers in space, where solar is plentiful, there's no need for water for cooling, and you can just beam the data right down.
All right. Problem solved. Sign me up. Sounds great. Safe Place and Rape Crisis Center, SPARC, is leading a month-long effort in April to recognize Sexual Assault Awareness Month. SPARC will host events to increase understanding and encourage community involvement. Two of the events include a month-long book display at Selby Library featuring books and resources around sexual violence, and Together in Teal, a Child Safety Day on Saturday, April 18th at the Walt Brewer Sports Complex in Arcadia. This family-friendly event includes interactive activities for children, safety education, and access to local resources. More information about SPARC and a full calendar of events is available at spark.net. And if you're not familiar with the acronym, it's S-P-A-R-C-C. So that's spark.net.
Thanks, Jono. And again, those of you out there listening, you're aware that we are in, you know, this week of the Giving Challenge. And this is the week where we reach out and ask our listeners for contributions and to contribute to the station and Fogartyville. And this Giving Challenge runs from noon tomorrow to noon on Thursday. And during that time, again, donations between $25 and $100 are matched dollar for dollar. And right now we're taking pledges. So you can call our office here, 941-894-6469. Make your pledge and we'll process it when the challenge begins so that you're gift is matched. It's simple, it's powerful, and it really makes a real meaningful impact on our local community. I mean, where else can you hear conversations like this? You know, they're not going to be on your regular news stations. And so if these public affairs programs here locally are important to you, we just encourage you to join and continue to be part of our community.
So, Jennifer, do you want to ask us the third question on your list?
You'll have to remind me what
or a follow-up.
What are the blind spots in how we talk about environment and growth?
Ah. Yeah, so what I mean by that, what are the blind spots? I think we've touched on it a little bit, which are, what are some of the misconceptions? But what's missing? What's the missing link between what the scientists understand about our changing environment and what is the public understanding of our changing environment? And I'll tee you off by mentioning scale, spatial scale, and temporal scale. I think those are two things that are really hard to explain and sort of wrap your head around.
Well, I'm willing to agree with that, but I'm going to bring up a different one, and that is, I don't think we're very good at measuring impacts, particularly in a governmental context. So both the city and the county now have given people permission to build accessory dwelling units. So this is an extra residence, small residence, limited size, that you can place on your lot, and then you pay an impact fee. Well, aside from the impacts during construction, the structure itself has zero impact. It doesn't increase traffic, doesn't use more water, it doesn't really do anything, it's just a box. It's how many people are using that box that determine the impact. If one person's there, that's a different impact than if three people are there. And yet we have no way of assessing the actual impact. There's just an assumption that if you have a building of this size, it's generating this amount of impact. We also have a problem with, we had provisions in our comprehensive plan that developers are supposed to pay for growth. Well, how do you allocate? This is another sort of allocation question of how do we measure that? And we end up with these, I guess what's called surrogation. We end up, it's hard to measure the thing we're actually interested in, and so we end up measuring a proxy, and then that gets you into trouble. So So that's an issue. But maybe we should talk about scale.
I think the loss of native habitats is having a tremendous impact on wildlife, and the insects that we depend on for pollination and all of that stuff. So I think converting native habitats into residential areas is impacting local water quality, local air quality, and wildlife.
Well, so and a scale issue is we have a pretty good program for protecting natural areas in Sarasota County, but how does that connect up to DeSoto County, Manatee County, or Charlotte County, where we work on connectivity around here? But if we're not connecting to adjacent counties, how's that working out? So, you know, I think a real story that should be told regionally is the decline of the regional planning councils. We used to have regional planning councils that were thinking broadly and dealing with regional issues like hurricane evacuation and regional water supply, electricity distribution, habitat connectivity, and they've been sequentially defunded and deauthorized. And so there are a lot of problems that can't be solved at the county level. They're intra-county issues that need a larger body to address them. And that's been a terrible loss that I think most people are unaware of.
Well, I'd like to give a shout-out to the Tampa Bay Regional Planning Council.
Okay.
Who's doing great work for the Tampa Bay region. And what you're referring to, Jono, is the fact that Sarasota County dropped out of the Southwest Florida Regional Planning Council, which includes Charlotte, Lee, and Collier. But for many aspects of planning, particularly around climate change, the Tampa Bay Regional Planning Council has adopted Sarasota County, or maybe it's the other way around. Sarasota County has chosen to work with Tampa Bay Regional Planning Council. So that's a positive development.
Well, we really should be in both because, for instance, the Miyaca River is part of what's driving Charlotte Harbor. And so that people in Lee and Charlotte County have to deal with decisions we're making here in Sarasota.
That's right. Our geography is attached to both Tampa Bay and Charlotte Harbor.
Yeah.
So that's the...
Well, we're what's keeping Tampa Bay away from Charlotte Harbor.
We're the buffer.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention that EcoBeat is journalist-facing, but there are some publicly-facing components of it that are relevant to our discussion today. Jono, you mentioned the Environmentally Sensitive Lands Program locally that buys up native lands for protection. There is a statewide program, the Florida Forever Program. There's the Florida Wildlife Corridor, which is directing that work. And locally, Big Waters Land Trust is working on those connections. I had the opportunity to help them with their strategic conservation plan, developing a big GIS model that helped them identify particular areas and watersheds and parcels within those that directly address their conservation values. And you can learn more about that, tying this back to my point, that EcoBeat is producing a monthly op-ed written by our member organizations. This one coming out this week to launch is by Christine Johnson, president of Big Waters Land Trust. These will be published monthly in the Sarasota Herald Tribune op-ed page and the Bradenton Herald op-ed page.
Thank you. You've been listening to Our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear our show on WBPV LP Radio 100.1 Bradenton or listen online.
Today's show number 85 featured Jennifer Schaefer, co-executive director of the Science and Environment Council of Southwest Florida, talking with us about the SEC and EcoBeat.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Previous shows of Our Changing Environment may be accessed at WSLR Archives,